Hi there, I'm Alex Usher, and this is Higher Education Strategy Associates, one podcast to start your day.
It starts off with this very high-tech syntho-sequency type thing, like this. That's the news. And the strings take the melody.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is the third edition of our podcast, One Podcast to Start Your Day. Today, a little bit of a different format, just one-on-one, me and Dale Kirby, who is Professor of Education at Memorial University of Newfoundland and Labrador. And formerly, in a former life, he was Minister of Education and Early Childhood Development. And so that puts you in a really interesting position, doesn't it, Dale? I think you may be one of the only education profs write all the time about government, but you actually know government, right? Like, I think you may be one of the very few people who's got a foot in both worlds. I mean, Newfoundland and Labrador is an interesting province, right? I mean, it has gone through booms and busts. So it's had times when it's had a lot of money to spend, and it's had times where it doesn't have a lot of money to spend. It's only got two institutions at the post-secondary level, and so that creates a different kind of dynamic between government and institutions, you know, the one college and the one university. And so, you know, maybe tell us a little bit about how Newfoundland and Labrador is different from the rest of the country. I mean, you've got it's a fairly unique history, it's a fairly unique policy-making environment. What does the rest of the country need to know about colleges and universities in your province?
Well, I mean, the question is, how much time do you have? I mean, really, we reflect on our history a lot, or at least we should. Most of the European settlers came here in the 17th century. We were a colony, British colony, then a self-governing dominion. So we were a country. I think we're the only country in the world to give up our sovereignty, which we did during the Great Depression. We had a bank crash here. The province sort of went in receivership for a period of time. And then we had a referendum to join Canada in 1949. So people are surprised sometimes when I go to international conferences, I tell them that story. But I mean, Newfoundland was poor, right? But arguably, we were like a third world country. We used to refer to countries in that way: malnutrition, high child mortality rates. The economy revolved largely around the fishery, and there was a lot of forestry, logging, and so on, very much manual labor jobs that didn't require a lot of advanced training, and then some mining. The university here is much younger than universities in Upper Canada. It was a two-year college, called Memorial University College, from 1925 to the time of Confederation. And there are some books that have been written that are very unflattering about the quality of education that was even delivered there. We had some, the vocational schools, so, you know, trades colleges didn't really come into existence until around the time of Confederation. The first public college was created around the time of Confederation. We had this system of district vocational schools that were opened, so that they're all around the province. Some have closed, but like many post-secondary institutions in the country, the college system has undergone a lot of consolidation and merger. So they were district vocational schools, they became regional colleges with multiple campuses, and then finally a province-wide provincial college consisting of all of them. In fact, the funny thing most people wouldn't know is that for a year there, it was actually called the Provincial College, and they had a sort of a contest to decide what to name College of the North Atlantic.
Just so I'm getting the timing right, that's early 1990s?
Mid-1990s,
yeah. Mid-90s, okay.
So we've had, you know, an interesting history, but the university is reasonably new, you know, in comparison to universities in Ontario and Nova Scotia even. And the college system has been merged and merged and merged, but is still relatively new. I mean, I guess Colleges are newer than universities, generally speaking, in the country. But that's sort of the history of how we got to the two institutions. There was one institution called the College of Fisheries that was merged, that became the Marine Institute, which later was merged into Marmora.
Interesting. But so tell me, though, because it seems to me that the relationship between government and Memorial University in particular is a lot more, how can I put this, fraught. Government seems to think it can take a much larger role than other governments in the province. So I would say it's only 15 years ago, I guess, that the province vetoed a university president that the university had chosen. How did that come to be, and how is there any prospect of that changing?
Well, on paper, the university is autonomous, right? In the statute, the Memorial University Act, it says in black and white that the authority to make all these decisions, fiduciary and so on, are vested in the Board of Regents. So it's the board, not the government, that makes those decisions. But I would say that sometimes the paper that's printed on is of rather low quality, because there has been quite a bit of political influence over time. That affair with the government of the time interfering with the presidential search process was one of the more extreme ones that I've experienced. But we had another one in the tuition freeze policy, and it became much more of a provincial government policy priority instead of a university priority. And that's another good example of the low quality of paper that statute sometimes written out on. And even now, when the current government was talking about lifting the tuition fee freeze in recent years, they were saying at the time, well, you know, we're going to allow the university to have more autonomy because it should have more autonomy. And then almost as soon as the horse had left the barn, as soon as the tuition freeze was lifted, the government announced that it amended the University Act to allow the Auditor General to have more oversight, and then has since basically started the Auditor General on what I would call a multi-year fishing expedition. And to quote from the press release, it says the Auditor General is going to determine if significant investments are being managed with due regard to the economy, efficiency, and effectiveness, whatever that means.
Let me ask you, one other thing that has really struck me about post-secondary education in Newfoundland over the last two decades, I remember it was when I was working at the Marine Institute, and Glenn Blackwood, who was the vice president for Marine, obviously he was there for a very long time, I think 15 years in total. He told me that in his tenure at Marine, there had been 20 different presidents at the College of North Atlantic, if you included all the interims. Why do they have such trouble keeping hold of presidents?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story and a short one. About 30 years ago, when I started down this road of wanting to be, less of a student activist, less of a policy activist, and more of an academic in this area, I was talking to a senior administrator in the system, and that person said to me, look, Dale, the university is arm's length and the college is elbow's length. And that's really, really sums it up. I mean, the government interferes with the working of the university, and doubly so when it comes to the workings of the college. There's political intervention and some would argue political interference. We've had instances where personality conflicts and turf battles end up with ministers dispatching presidents via the Board of Governors based on some combination of advice from the senior bureaucracy within the ministry and then within the system. That's the best I can tell you. The college presidency wouldn't be a job that I would be applying for. Let me put it that way. I think they've damaged their brand somewhat by having that amount of churn when it comes to leadership. But we'll see what happens. I think one of the things that's unfortunate when it comes to the college is it has not really managed to capitalize on the international student recruitment in the same way that other college non-university post-secondary institutions in Canada have managed to capitalize on international student recruitment. If you look at their enrollment numbers, they're certainly not like some we've seen at other institutions, including the one just down the road from them, Memorial, which has a significant reliance on international students these days.
Right. Outside Newfoundland, I think one of the things that the province is known for is the fact that it has low tuition fees. And you've got a really interesting view on this because, of course, you were part of that. If I remember correctly, you were part of that as a student leader in the province, and you saw it from that perspective, and you've seen it from the perspective of a minister in a government that had to sustain that policy, and you've seen it from the perspective of a researcher who's looked at the effects on access and migration and that kind of stuff. What's the 2-minute version of what's been the effect of 20 years of a tuition freeze?
Yeah, I mean, I was very much on the vanguard of this as a student activist with the CFS back in the 90s. That was the period of time where tuition was increasing and grants were replaced with loans, student debt was going up. It was a very, very different situation than today. Inflation, by the time they got around to getting rid of the tuition fee freeze, inflation adjusted tuition for Newfoundlanders and Labradorians was less than what it was for me when I attended there in the 1990s. So after 1999, the funding was sort of apportioned by the provincial government separate from the grant and aid to cover the freeze for the university and the college. And there seemed to be an agreement with both parties on the freeze between institutions and government. But that all started to unravel just a few years ago when the province started cutting the university budget while still insisting on holding the freeze. And it became sort of like a Potemkin village. For example, in 2016, the province earmarked $4 million for the freeze and cut the overall operating grant by several times that amount. So we were arguing that the freeze was covered, but of course that was really a bit of a facade. What was the impact? Obviously students paid lower tuition fees, especially students here in Newfoundland and Labrador had much lower costs than students in the rest of the country. We saw some spikes there. I wrote a couple of papers about maritime students coming here. In Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, tuition fees were going up. So for a few years, we had a spike in enrollment from there. My friend, who is a public policy commenter, used to say that the policy was cheap tuition for mainlanders. So people started to get a bit concerned that, and the Auditor General wrote a piece on this several years back, about how much money was going towards subsidizing this freeze for individuals from out of the province, if you look at the overall investment in the university. That satisfied groups that are, I would say, ideologically believe in this mantra that free or cheap tuition fees with no regard to the net cost to students, that's sort of a job well done. That doesn't account for those who are left out of that narrow model of access that bases access on this idea that tuition fees are, that create access, because that's not true. And we have to look at the overall cost. But if you want to look at the effect of the tuition fee freeze, come to our campus and look at the crumbling infrastructure. That's just one example, and that has impact on learning, and it has impact on the ability of faculty to conduct research, to have research output, to attract research funding. But more than that, there were more for students, there were more non-tuition fees. It was like, hey, we'll freeze your tuition, but hey, look how much more you're going to pay in residence fees and meal plans and other service fees. We have larger classes and fewer course choices. We have more top courses being taught by short-term contractual faculty on top of that. In my own faculty, it's been a policy for several years now, since all of this started to unravel, that we have to have 3 retirements of tenured faculty before we can advertise a new tenure track appointment. Another problem, we have less competitive staff salaries. So we have problems recruiting staff because we can't pay as much as other employers in the province. So that leads to delays in processes like admissions, anything that involves a chain of approvals. So that problem with having staff recruitment and staff shortages, it exists to this day, and it's probably worse than it was than the pandemic. So we have fewer staff to support programs. We end up having slower processes, reduced student services, challenges to provide services, and again, on top of that, the crumbling infrastructure. So I don't have a really positive story to tell you about the tuition fee freeze. When I was a young student activist back in the 90s, I really didn't envision it ending up this way. And I think in large part, it was because the tuition freeze was not fully funded. In the absence of that, we probably should have had an inflation adjusted tuition fee in any case. We probably should have that now. I would argue most institutions should have that and look at other things that enable students to access post-secondary education beyond the cost of the tuition. But anyways, that's a long-winded answer and not an overly flattering one, but that's how I see it.
Now, of course, you talked about the amount of money that the government's been able to put into Memorial, as you say, and you know, there were a few years there where there was a lot of money going into Memorial. More recently, there have been cuts. I think the peak year was around 2013 or 14 when there was still oil price was high and exploration money was still coming in. So it's been about a decade of decline since then. And then, of course, you had what was called the Big Reset, and that was a new government in, or at least a new leader in a recently elected government. And you had, I think it was cuts of 20 or 25% across the board in post-secondary education that were meant to be brought in over 5 years. Tell us about that Big Reset and how has it affected Memorial, I guess almost a year and a half on from that?
Well, the province has serious fiscal problem in that we are overly reliant on the cost of a barrel of oil, and we have fairly large public service, and it's labor intensive, and we're spending a lot more than we're bringing in, and somebody is going to have to pay for that at some point. So the current premier, promised a lot of change when he was coming in, big changes in fiscal policy, more prudence, if you will. They appointed these outside individuals to provide advice to the premier and his cabinet on future directions for the province. But it's largely been shelved. The big impacts we're going to see are going to be the result of not doing anything in response to that. I mean, there have been some aesthetic changes. Around the same time, they also had a review of post-secondary education. There's this report called All Hands on Deck, and I keep saying it should have been called Consider, Enhance, and Explore, because that was the sort of thing. It was over 300 pages of everything but the kitchen sink, and really didn't provide any strategic direction for post-secondary education. But I think these two processes were more about delaying doing anything about the fiscal problem than they were about coming up with solutions. Oftentimes you'll see governments doing this when they come into office, instead of, and especially ones that are more left-leaning or liberal, instead of acting on these overly generous things that they campaigned on during the election, they'll have a review or a task force or a panel of experts spend the next 8 to 12, 14 months doing some intro retrospection, and then hoping that the fiscal or something is different at the end. And of course, it's not. So,
hang on a sec, because in Newfoundland it is, right? Because you have a plan. We're going to cut so much out of government. We're going to get, 25% reduction in the funds to Kona and Memorial. And then within 12 months, there's the Muskrat Falls bailout and the price of oil goes back up, right? So
yeah,
maybe that was it, right? Maybe that was the deus ex machina that we needed to.
On the post-secondary end, I was a cabinet minister when the decision was made to do the post-secondary review, and I was the person who recommended it. And it was evident that the premier at the time was not interested in, I think the 2016 budget had some rollbacks and was met with a lot of opposition. And so our government was concerned about doing a whole lot of anything else in the reducing line. And so I think they were just a bit shocked about doing anything. So we had done a comprehensive review to K-12 in the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. I oversaw that. And so I said, well, why don't we do a review of post-secondary? If you're not going to act on the tuition issue now, have someone from the outside come in, and then, prior to the next election, you'll have something you can, act on or not, but at least it buys some time if you don't want to, deal with the tuition fee issue. And that issue, again, was this Potemkin village of, saying we're funding the freeze while, cutting, several times that amount from the base operating budget of the university. So that's what was done. But I mean, because I was a guy in the room, I can tell you that it was an exercise in delay. And the tuition fee freeze issue was subsequently dealt with, because of that report. And the Great Reset report was another report. It, bought into this idea, obviously. And then the government was able to say, well, hey, look, we've got not one, but two reports saying we should get rid of the freeze. And the university thinks we should get rid of the freeze. So, hey, who are we to say we should keep it, right? So it was, again, this exercise in washing your hands of any responsibility for making that decision. They did do something really positive, I think the province did, which was bring in an enhanced student aid model, increased grants for students from Newfoundland and Labrador. So that was a good thing that came out of it for sure. But if you go and look at those reports, but especially the Great Reset one, Alex, very few things that were in that have been done. And, it will be another government that does a whole lot of anything that's in there, because it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of interest.
So let me ask you one last question. I mean, the obvious, if you're a university in a province that has trouble making ends meet, and there's a lot of opposition to large domestic tuition fee increases, surely the logical end game is a much larger international student presence, because that's the swing money really in higher education in Canada. And I know Memorial has done quite a job in attracting some of those students. What do you think the likelihood is that it starts heading down that route, that given that you've got, it's the one province where young people, the number of young people is actually decreasing, right? It's increasing in the other nine provinces, but it's going down in Newfoundland. What do you think the odds are of Memorial going down the same route as, say, Cape Breton University, which, is now well over 50% international, because that's the only way to keep the lights on and get rid of the buckets along those corridors?
Well, I'm from rural Newfoundland, and I'm the same as all the rest of those people from rural Newfoundland. I love it, and I wish what was happening there, it wasn't happening, but it is happening, and it's happening all over the world, Alex, that people are increasingly moving to larger population centers, and our industry has changed much here in the province, and our feeder population from the high schools is just going down more than, or less than half of what it was in the 70s. And so we have far fewer domestic local students to draw upon. There have been changes, the tuition fee structure is not as attractive for other Canadian students to come here. Some will for a lengthy period of time. There's no doubt there'll be some of that. But I think there's difficult decisions that will be made down the road just because they will have to be made, because it's not going to be sustainable without some change. The chances of this happening becoming an institution much like CBU, with all of this reliance or continued and more reliance on international students, I think that's entirely plausible, highly likely. The problem there, of course, we learned during the pandemic, it didn't happen the way that it might have. But I think we just learned or remembered how over-reliant we are on international student recruitment to keep the lights on at the institution. So it's quite possible that Memorial University will head in that direction. It's also quite possible that College of North Atlantic will have to start more aggressively looking to recruit, because their campuses around the provinces are seeing similar challenges when it comes to recruiting smaller and smaller pool of local high school graduates. But back to your main point, yes, I mean, we are going to continue to rely on international student recruitment, because really there's not a lot of other options. We'll have to do something, and that something is probably going to be international student recruitment. The problem there again is there's a top to that as well, right? There's only so much you can charge and remain competitive with the rest of the country and the other competitor nations in that top five or so.
Good stuff. Dale, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
One podcast to start your day is a Higher Education Strategy Associates production, produced by Tiffany McLennan and Samantha Pupak.